This is VOA News. In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. Israel's military chief says the country will respond to Iran's weekend attack of more than 300 missiles and drones. Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi said Monday that Israel still considering its steps, but that the Iranian strike of missiles and attack drones will be met with a response. World leaders have been urging Israel not to retaliate. The U.S. Monday joined its allies in urging Israel to show restraint and avoid an escalation in the conflict in the Middle East. Director of the Washington Institute's Koret Project on Arab-Israel Relations, David Makovsky, told VOA's Kim Lewis the attack, the first ever direct action against Israel by Iran, was too unprecedented for Israel not to respond.
I do think there will be a retaliation, but what's unclear is when and if it's going to be what we call a high signature or low signature, meaning it's going to be very overt, or is it going to be a cyber thing where there's deniability? But I think it's too big of a development in the Middle East for it just to be washed away.
A UN-mandated commission of inquiry Tuesday accused Israel of actively obstructing its efforts to collect evidence from the victims of the attack by Hamas in southern Israel October 7th. During a meeting in Geneva, one of three commission members, Chris Sidati, said they'd been collecting physical, digital, and documentary evidence from the October 7th attacks, but the commission has had difficulty collecting firsthand accounts from witnesses and victims.
So far as the government of Israel is concerned, we have faced not merely a lack of cooperation, but active obstruction of our efforts to receive evidence from Israeli witnesses and victims to the events that occurred in southern Israel.
In response to Sidati's comments, the Israeli diplomatic mission in Geneva said it has been carrying out its own investigation of the crimes and that representatives from the UN have been to Israel. This is VOA News. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has returned to a New York courtroom Tuesday as a jury selection in his historic hush money trial enters its second day. The former president began the day by railing about the trial and a gag order that bars him from publicly commenting on jurors, potential witnesses, and others. In an interview with the Associated Press, former federal prosecutor David Weinstein said it will be challenging for the former president to sit quietly in a courtroom for most of the day.
It is going to be one of the hardest things for him to do. He is outspoken. We've seen that before court, after court. We've seen outbursts in other cases that he's had. And for him, being quiet, knowing that while he is the focal point of attention, he can't say anything.
Brazilian police are investigating the discovery of a boat full of corpses off the South American country's coasts. They say the dead were likely African migrants from Mali and Mauritania. Details from VOA's Tommy McNeil.
Fishermen off Brazil's northern coastal state of Para had found the boat adrift Saturday in the Atlantic Ocean. Brazil's federal police said in a statement late Monday it had recovered 9 dead. The large white and blue canoe-shaped boat found in Brazil shares the same characteristics of Mauritanian fishing pirogues, frequently used by West African migrants to reach Spain's Canary Islands. Brazil was likely not their destination. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
A plan by Britain's government to introduce a landmark smoking ban that aims to stop young people from ever starting to smoke is expected to clear its first hurdle Tuesday, despite vocal opposition from within Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative Party. The bill, a key policy announced by Sunak last year, will make it illegal to sell tobacco products to anyone after January 1, 2009. China's economy grew by 5.3% in the first quarter of 2024, beating expectations. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
China's economy has beaten expectations in the first quarter of the year with help from policies and stronger demand. The world's second largest economy expanded at a 5.3% annual pace in January to March, surpassing analysts' forecasts of about 4.8%. Compared to the previous quarter, the economy expanded 1.6%. Policymakers have unveiled a raft of fiscal and monetary policy measures meant to boost the economy and financial markets. Beijing set an ambitious gross domestic product growth target of about 5% for 2024. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You'll find more on this and all the stories we're covering today at our website, voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on African News Tonight.
What we're seeing here is a level of risk acceptance on behalf of the Iranians, which I think has the potential to plunge the entire region into a war. And if we take the Iranians at their word, inadvertently, that's very, very, very dangerous. So I am concerned.
That was Dave DeRoche, an associate professor at the U.S. Defense University, on the risks that Iran took in its attack on Israel. Details coming up. Also, an ECOWAS delegation is expected in Togo amid tensions soaring over a constitutional reform. And international donors have pledged over $2 billion in funding for battered Sudan. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Several African leaders have called for restraint in the wake of Iran's attack on Israel, which some regional analysts say could lead to a wider conflict in the Middle East. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi has warned Israel and its allies against any reckless actions after Tehran's drone and missile attack Saturday, the first time Iran has launched a direct military assault on Israeli territory. Darren Taylor has the story.
Many regional analysts say a broader conflict in the Middle East involving some of the world's great military powers would have disastrous consequences, especially for Africa's weaker economies. But they differ about what Iran's attack Saturday on Israel means.
This is not an escalation. This is more, in my opinion, diplomacy at a high level. Let's call it armed diplomacy that is unfolding.
Professor Abel Esterhazy is a military strategist at Stellenbosch University in South Africa.
The attack from Iran was probably the most telegraphed assault in the history of war. Everybody knew it's going to come. They made sure through diplomatic channels in Switzerland and Turkey that the U.S. understands that Iran don't want the war to escalate, but they don't want to lose face. They had to react and respond to the killing of the commanders of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria. So this was, in my opinion, more a symbolic attack than anything else.
Iran fired armed drones and missiles at Israel on Saturday, but Israel and its allies, including the United States and Jordan, say they shot down almost all of them. The attack came after an airstrike on an Iranian consulate in Syria earlier this month that killed several Iranian military commanders. Tehran blames Israel for the airstrike, but the Israeli government has not said it was responsible. As the director of the Geneva Center for African Security and Strategic Studies, David Otto, points out, whether Iran's attack is considered symbolic depends entirely on Israel.
What is very critical is that the world now is drifting towards, you know, what I consider to be a conventional Third World War. I mean, Iran has now launched over 300 explosive drones. The U.S. has said that it will not engage in retaliation or direct retaliation, perhaps, in order not to escalate the conflict. But one never knows.
South African government officials tell VOA that International Relations Minister Naledi Pandor has communicated directly with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to appeal for tensions to be scaled down with Israel. Pretoria has good relations with Raisi's administration, especially since it lobbied successfully for Iran to join the BRICS Plus bloc of emerging economies. Pandor says she speaks regularly with the Iranians about getting more aid into Gaza, which has been devastated by Israel's war with Hamas militants for the past 6 months. South Africa's former ambassador to Israel, Sisa Ngombane, says the best way to prevent a wider war in the Middle East would be an end to the Gaza conflict. Ngombane calls on all African governments, civil society groups, and the African Union to be very loud in their appeals for no war in the Middle East.
You need all these organizations to be really seized with this matter. It can't be that like a something happening in a corner somewhere where nobody sees, because the consequences are dire for all of us. We need to be involved as citizens of the world. Let's go to the streets to press on our leaders to do the right thing. Because until the politicians feel that they are under pressure to do the right thing, they will continue to take decisions that are contrary to our interests.
He says he's confident the U.S. will use its powers of persuasion to prevent Israel from launching a major retaliation. The fighting in Gaza has killed nearly 34,000 people and left most of the territory's 2 million people near famine. The conflict began in October after Hamas fighters attacked Israeli communities, killing about 1,200 people and taking more than 240 hostage. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Following yesterday's International Humanitarian Pledging Conference for Sudan in Paris, aid groups say it brought much-needed attention to Sudan's increasingly forgotten crisis, but it does not end there. Mercy Corps Country Director for Sudan, Sibongali Kayola, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the aid group is still facing a shortfall of about $2 billion to respond to the urgency in Sudan and neighboring countries where Sudanese have fled to escape the fighting.
We welcome the announcement of the commitment of 2 billion euros to respond to the urgent needs of people inside Sudan and in neighboring countries as well. Whilst this pledge is quite generous, we also have to be realistic, because what has been received represents only 20 cents per day for each person facing urgent needs in Sudan and in neighboring countries as well. Whilst we appreciate these funds, it has to be said that more funds are needed, and these funds need to be dispersed immediately to humanitarian responders.
There's talk of famine in Sudan right now. Will this amount of money, if it comes through, because I understand these are commitments at this point, will it avert a famine?
Unfortunately, by the time famine is declared, it would be too late. And waiting until we receive a declaration of famine to scale up assistance would lead to hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths and have repercussions for many years to come. This amount, whilst it will go a long way in helping to alleviate the situation, much more is needed. And preventing famine really requires donors to go beyond what has been pledged to ensure that we make the most of where we are today and prevent famine.
About how many people are facing severe acute hunger in Sudan right now?
18 million people, which is equivalent to one-third of Sudan's population, is facing severe food shortages. And the most recent food security analysis indicated that 17.7 million people, or nearly 40% of the population, have been affected or are in dire need of immediate food assistance.
So this pledging conference was held in France, and the French have already pledged an amount. What are they offering, and what have other countries? What has the United States pledged?
Individual donors have pledged different amounts. The United States and France have been very generous with the pledges that have come in. But as I said earlier, we really need to see those pledges being backed by concrete actions as soon as possible.
That's Mercy Corps Country Director for Sudan, Sibongani Kayola. And in more from Sudan, the Sudanese American Physician Association and other human rights groups held a rally yesterday in Washington, D.C.'s Freedom Square to demand action as the conflict in Sudan marked its first anniversary. More than 14,000 civilians have been killed in the war, 10 million have been forced to flee their homes, and millions are on the brink of famine. Dr. Huzaifa Sahlim, Assistant Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the Sudanese war is one of the worst humanitarian crises of the past decade, and the world can no longer stand by and watch.
The need for a resolution cannot be overstated. We have felt that this rally needs to be held due to the lack of attention towards this crisis. Out of estimated $2.7 billion that needs to be allocated for humanitarian aid to help alleviate some of the burdens of this crisis, only 5% have been delivered. We firmly believe that action needs to be taken and Sudan needs to be talked about We are talking about complete communities that are collapsing. People are suffering. People are dying every day. We're talking about people who woke up today who do not know what to eat for lunch or for dinner. We're talking about pregnant women who do not know where to go to deliver their babies. We're talking about dialysis patients, one of which was a dear friend of my father, who doesn't have a center to go to, as 83% of healthcare facilities have completely shut down or partly working.
Speaking of the disintegration, basically, of infrastructure in and around the cities like Khartoum, the capital, and other places, what does Khartoum look like these days? Because it's hard to get in there since I understand it's a war zone and journalists have fled too for their safety.
It's completely devastating. People are helpless. We are a very locally active group, like our association. We work very actively on the ground, and getting simple supplies like IV solutions or medications to those who need is very difficult and very cumbersome, just given the amount of insecurity and lack of safety to mobilize and to move things around. People have been very catastrophic.
Is your group still there in Khartoum?
Our members are part of our local partners. So we work here in the U.S., but part of our office is in Khartoum. We had to mobilize and move to Madani, Al Jazeera, which had been hit back in December. And unfortunately, now we have to mobilize again and move our hub and kind of centers. We work all around Sudan, mostly about 7 out of the 18 states now. But because it's difficult, just given the logistics of the war, to try to get through and set up a facility or a healthcare center. So part of our local partners and local physicians who are Sudanese physicians, but they're working on behalf of ours. They're on the ground. Yeah.
Tell me why you've organized this march to the White House. You're aiming this at American lawmakers, but it's also aimed at the international community, right?
Absolutely. We think the international community, given its international agencies as well, really needs to take a strong stance and take action against all the violence that's been taken, but also increase funding significantly. I mean, as I said, talking about 5%, that's like, you know, I live here in the U.S., and that's sometimes it's less than the budget of some cities here. We're talking about the localization of aid. You know, groups like ours and others, partners and NGOs that are Sudanese-made and Sudanese-motivated and deeply passionate groups, we have resources and we have people that can work there, but we can't work without the funds to be able to get these supplies, to be able to increase our attention and, you know, our presence in the world, basically.
That was Dr. Huzaifa Sahalim, Assistant Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. West Africa's regional bloc ECOWAS says a delegation is expected in Togo this week as tensions soar over a constitutional reform the opposition says will extend President Faure Gnassingbé's rule. The Economic Community of West African States said its mission would interact with the main stakeholders on the latest developments in Togo before legislative and regional elections on April 29th. The French news agency AFP reports that the delegation is led by Maman Sambo Siduku, a former head of the African Union's mission in Mali and the Sahel. He will stay until April 20th following a government invitation. Tensions have soared in Togo since last month when lawmakers backed a constitutional reform to shift to a parliamentary system where lawmakers would elect the president for a 6-year term. The opposition fears it is a ploy to extend the rule of Gnassingbé, who has been in office since 2005 and won re-election in multiple votes condemned as fraudulent by his rivals. a high-level pledging conference co-sponsored by Ethiopia, Britain, and the United Nations is seeking $3.2 billion to provide life-saving humanitarian aid for millions of Ethiopians suffering from conflict and back-to-back climate shocks. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Last month's UN-backed $3.2 billion humanitarian response plan is less than 5% funded. This is far from enough to address the dire needs of 15.5 million people in Ethiopia. Ambassador Shifra Tekle-Mariam is commissioner of the Ethiopian Disaster Risk Management Commission. He says he hopes today's event will turn things around and donor nations will provide critical life-saving support to Ethiopia. Failure to do so, he warns, will have serious consequences.
And while we are coming out of the COVID pandemic, and at the same time several disasters, including epidemics, locusts, displacements, as we have already raised, is an issue which we have to address, and that's what we were saying. We have really to act before it's too late.
The United Nations reports food insecurity and malnutrition are expected to peak at 10.8 million people during the July-September lean season. Britain's Deputy Foreign Secretary and Minister for Development in Africa, Andrew Mitchell, recently visited Ethiopia. He says he saw increasingly worrying signs of famine-like conditions emerging in conflict areas in the north.
What we found when we went up into Tigray and looked at the areas where the marginalization and the difficulties were taking place, we found an increasing number of people, particularly children, suffering from malnutrition with the pipeline growing.
At the same time, he says years of conflict in Tigray and other regions have destroyed or damaged thousands of schools, health facilities, water systems, and other community infrastructure. Mitchell says people whose coping mechanisms are being seriously eroded by drought and conflict are selling whatever they have to survive. He says Ethiopia will need at least $1 billion to cover aid for the next 3 months. Last year, USAID and the UN's World Food Program suspended food aid to Ethiopia amid allegations that the food was being diverted. The Ethiopian government denied this. Conference organizers say food distributions resumed in December following stringent reforms to prevent anything similar from occurring. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Secretary General's envoy to the Sahara, Staffan de Mistura, is briefing the Security Council today on the latest developments in the Western Sahara conflict and is consulting with concerned parties in the regional dispute. The Security Council issued a resolution in October that urged all parties to resume negotiations towards a just, lasting, and mutually acceptable political solution that guarantees self-determination for the people of Western Sahara. William Lawrence, a former U.S. diplomat who worked on this issue, has low expectations for this session and explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi why.
As a diplomat, we need a pragmatic solution to the problem. We need to work on the existing agreements. In terms of the expectation session, my expectations are low because we haven't had enough. I've talked to a lot of the previous envoys and to this envoy's staff. And the hard thing about being an envoy is you're not forcing any solutions. You have to have everybody agree before you do anything. So it's really, really hard. And often what you'll see envoys do, like we saw Bathy, the Libyan envoy, recently do, is you try to come up with like a new approach to old problems to solve old problems. And so he created this new, you know, five mechanism. So I would expect De Mistura to do something like that. So kind of figure out some mechanism to put a new angle on things. But really what needs to be solved are the problems we've been dealing with since the 90s and before.
Although the Polisario receives weapons and political support from Algeria, Algeria says we are not a party to the Western Sahara conflict. So how would the UN envoy move forward with this position?
Politically, of course, Algeria is a party to the conflict. That's why they've gone to the previous rounds of negotiations. I think what they're doing, though, is they're making a legal point, because only the Sahrawis can give up their rights under international law to join the Moroccan autonomy plan. So the negotiations mean the Sahrawis are the only party that says we agree to be part of the Moroccan state going forward. And so in that sense, I think the way to imagine any negotiation is Morocco and Polisario in the front row and Algeria and Mauritania in the back row, and it can't work without that formula.
How legitimate is Polisario representation to the Sahrawi population in the Western Sahara?
Well, it's not representative according to the democratic metric because we don't have, you know, free and fair elections with multiple parties competing in the camps, etc. So in that sense, it's not representative. But it's representative in the sense that Polisario created the movement, right? This goes back to the 1970s. It was Polisario that created the camps. It's Polisario that created, if you want to say it, the problem, you know, in a decolonization process in Western Africa. So just like Hamas doesn't represent Palestinians, you don't get a deal without Hamas, right? You don't get a deal without Polisario. So, you know, I think ultimately you're going to have to negotiate with Polisario, have the Algerians part of the conversation, have other groups, if in some way the opposition among Sahrawis can be included in that conversation, why not? Ultimately, the representativity doesn't get you peace, and it doesn't get you to peace and doesn't get you to a long-term solution.
That was William Lawrence, a former U.S. diplomat, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. For most pregnant women in the slums of Nairobi, ultrasound services are an unaffordable luxury. Now, a Kenyan healthcare business is using portable, low-cost ultrasound systems to give expecting mothers a chance to see their babies and detect any health problems before the delivery day. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Sophia Ameida is looking at her fetus for the first time at this clinic in Kenya's Mukuru Kwa Ruben slum. Ameida is due in a few weeks. She says getting an ultrasound is critical for her because her first baby was delivered by cesarean section. They could not tell how the baby was positioned, she adds. Ameida says at the time of delivery, the baby was not moving down at all, so she had to go for surgery. For most women in Kenyan slums, often called informal settlements, this type of medical technology is out of reach. One session can cost as much as $60. But with a relatively new ultrasound device called a butterfly probe, patients like Ameida can get an ultrasound for just $10. The device is designed by the US-based health tech company Butterfly Network. The probe can connect to a tablet or a mobile phone, making it portable and easy to use for sonographers like Alfred Kibet.
It enables you to reduce the cost of doing ultrasound, because you see with the other traditional machines, ultrasound machines, they are quite expensive, and again, the other components involved, like you need a printer, a special printer. And so, but with this, you can just store the images and then you can print with a regular printer.
Healthcare companies like Access Afia are partnering to provide the devices to clinics, especially in densely populated areas. The goal is to close the gap of affordable healthcare, says Access Afia's finance director, Danny McCabe.
They don't need to be focused on how do I get a payback immediately on this machine and be focused on, hey, how do I make the highest price possible for these machines? You can be focused on providing the best level of care and then working with us to make sure there's enough foot traffic here to make sure that at the end of the day, everyone's able to make their money back on the machine.
Kenya has among the world's highest rates of maternal deaths, according to UN figures. Nurse midwife Millie Karina says ultrasounds can help to detect and avert most difficulties at birth, like when a woman is carrying twins.
Sometimes I've found that we're in labor with a mom, but we didn't know there were two. We thought it was one, but there are two. So that can complicate things a little bit for the mom, not knowing. Number two, mothers have lost pregnancies because the placenta was insufficient. And it could something that could have been picked up really early, but unfortunately, it happens.
Kenyan healthcare providers believe that lower cost of medical technologies like ultrasound will help to lower infant and maternal death. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yeshuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Bill Androdi, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.